is mostly work in progress, and it's always a little bit dangerous perhaps to talk about work in progress. So what I wanted to do is sort of a mixed format. So this is work that's finished, although the last part is not written up yet, it's not in a paper yet. Has some connections with quantum error correction. So I guess I have an hour until 4:45. True?
Yeah.
So the first half hour, 45 minutes, I'll spend on this, and then I have some more provocative thoughts for the last 10 minutes, say, that are more physics-oriented. So we did an analysis of a construction which we have called the space-time circuito-Hamiltonian construction. And I think most of you know what the standard circuito-Hamiltonian construction is. It's a mapping of any quantum circuit onto the ground state of the Hamiltonian, and the Hamiltonian has the whole history state of the circuit as its ground state. And this construction is essential in quantum complexity theory if you want to prove that determining the ground state energy of a class of Hamiltonians is QMA complete. It's hard for quantum computers to use this. And you can also use it to prove that quantum adiabatic computation is universal for quantum computation. And you can also use it to construct universal quantum walks. And so so our analysis is a generalization and is inspired by the person who sits here in front, Ari Mizell. Well, I mean, so it's basically coming out of an analysis of his construction, but then phrasing it in a more general way. And I think, I hope that there are many more applications of this construction. So like I said, I won't talk about the standard construction. Is that okay? I think everybody knows this. So what you do is you define, okay, maybe I'll say very briefly. So we have a quantum circuit with qubits. And in order to construct our Hamiltonian, we define a clock. And there's one big clock for the whole, all the qubits. And whenever we have a Hamiltonian, whenever a gate is applied, the gate UT, so we linearly order the gates from U1 to UL. Whenever unitary is applied, the clock, we have a term in the Hamiltonian, so the clock moves forward, unitary is applied. And because it has the Hermitian, you also have a term that, lets time run backwards and undoes the unitary. Okay, so the thing is that, what's easy about this model is that, what's nice about this model, you can analyze the spectrum of this Hamiltonian quite easily because it maps onto a 1D line of particle hopping. And this particle is essentially where the particle is that notes where the time is. Okay, so in the space-time construction, what I find interesting about is that it's a construction that preserves a lot more about the original quantum circuit. So in the Kitaev construction, you take the quantum circuit, you order the gates from the first gate to the last gate, and that defines then some Hamiltonian, and you've lost the structure like the depth or the locality is the quantum circuit that you make from nearest neighbor interactions in 2D or 3D and so on. And so the nice thing about the space-time construction is that it preserves these properties. So what I'm going to do, what we were able to do, is to analyze this construction for a 1D circuit. So we mapped a 1D circuit onto Hamiltonian with specific features. One could also do this, it is a general thing, you could do this for a 2D circuit, in two-dimensional nearest neighbor, 3D, for a MIRA, whatever. Yeah? But the point is that actually the spectral gap analysis for those more general circuits may be quite hard, although I do think that actually there are some, that it will map onto some nice models. There will be generalizations, but anyhow. So what we assume is that we have a circuit like this. We have a line of n qubits, yeah? So space is one-dimensional, and it has a certain depth, p. Yeah, and they're just nearest neighbor interaction alternating with your left or your right neighbor. For some technical reasons, we actually assume periodic boundary conditions in space. We will also assume periodic boundary conditions in time, but this is sort of a technical thing. Okay, so why this relates to the work by Mizell et al., which already appeared quite a while ago, and I think it was an open question to further understand this construction, and sort of this is what we've done. So he considered a Hamiltonian. So he also took a 1D circuit. And so there's a bunch of qubits in that 1D circuit. Is there actually a pointer here? The hockey stick, yeah, okay. Yeah, I'll do the hockey stick. Yeah, so we have qubits Q in the original quantum circuit. And now every qubit Q will get replaced by a, what you could call a double track of particles that can hop. So the idea is that this double track, there's only actually, there's different ways of looking at it. You can say you initialize your qubit in a zero or one state. If it's one, you put the particle over here. If it's zero, you put the particle over there. Yeah. And then what the Hamiltonian does is that if it's just a single qubit gate, this particle just moves forward. Yeah? So for example, if a NOT gate is done, it would map from here to there, yeah? And from there to there. But if it's some Hadamard gate or something, not hop from there to there, not deterministically, but would be a superposition of being there and there after the gate. Yeah? So you could look at this as a line of fermionic modes, yeah? In which you have a single particle that can hop on this line in this direction. Or you can also think about that, well, I just have a fermion with spin, and the spin state labels 0 and 1, and that particle is just hopping forward while changing its internal space. Very natural way of thinking about a qubit, of course. Yeah? So that's for a single qubit gate. Yeah. And so for a single qubit gate, you say that you're represented by a single particle hopping on a track or a line, and changing its internal state. Now, okay, so how do you represent, or how are two qubit gates represented in this model? So there you say the particles have to hop together. So you say that, for example, for C0 gates, you say both particles, they hop together forward, and depending on where this particle is and which track it is, the other particle goes either straight or goes left. So it flips its, spin is flipped. Yeah? So you can realize any controlled U gate in the way he set it up with particle creation annihilation operators. And you can also see that they're both at the gate, so they can. Okay, so the thing is that this was originally formulated as in terms of fermions, but this is not really essential because these particles, they always go just, forward or backward. So essentially it's one dimensional. So this was formulated in terms of, creation annihilation operators of modes. These can be fermionic, they can be bosonic, and you also think about just particles. Okay.
Barbara, yeah. So you're going to be serializing the circuits you simulate as well then, sort of the standard construction of some of these things?
Serializing? You mean parallelizing? No. I'm not going to serialize. No, I just want to keep it parallel.
So typically in these clock-based constructions, if you have one clock trying to get in.
Yeah, but I'm not having one clock. Every qubit will have its own clock. The point is the way to think about this is that every qubit has its own clock. So every point in space there is a clock, and if there's only single qubit gates, these clocks can be completely unsynchronized. Yeah, and what happens that if the two nearest neighbor qubits clocks, they're both running, and only when they're both synchronized at a certain point in time they can be advanced together. That's sort of but we'll see that in a moment. Any other questions? Okay, so one thing about, it's not so important for this talk particularly, but you can ask one of the motivations is that this model that Mizell wrote down and that we have analyzed is interesting because perhaps the interactions that you require are more physically reasonable, because in his model there were single particle hopping terms and quadratic terms and quartic terms. I say, oh, quadratic, quartic, that's easy, because in some sense that's more easy than if you take like the KTF standard construction, you get some 5 local Hamiltonian, not completely natural. But actually, it's not. You would say it's not completely natural. So what you expect, if you say, well, I want to get this from the Coulomb interaction, or some, if it's for bosons, some nonlinearity. So I need always some interaction because particles have to hop together. So they have to be annihilated together in these modes and created together in some other modes. But you can imagine that with some Coulomb interaction, you could you know, perturbatively generate these interactions. So that's what this slide sketches. But I don't actually want to go into this so much. So, okay. So so the point is that if the original circuit is one-dimensional, then this Hamiltonian is an interacting fermion Hamiltonian, two dimensions. So with quadratic and quartic interactions, So so we want to understand the properties of this construction. We want to understand what is the can we use this for QMA and for other purposes? How can we bound the gap and so on? Okay, so so first we set up the formalism a bit more generally. I also want to point out that there is this type of model has been looked at before by Margolis and also by Jansing. Come to the end of my talk. And the sad thing is that, you know, work by Margolis is by now sort of, you know, almost forgotten. And so we actually, I hadn't read that paper and forgot about it first. But it's good to remember that some of these things had already been done before. Okay, so now I just want to define the sort of more space-time construction in which this Mizell Hamiltonian is a particular clock realization, basically. And so the idea is that we have a quantum circuit, we have qubits, and now we just, and so they are distributed over space somewhere, and we just define a clock for every qubit. And this clock runs from zero to the depth of the circuit. It's not going to run, you know, so that's different. So you can, what I found interesting is to see whether there were any results that were only related to the depth instead of to the whole size of the circuit. And so in principle, we have the, now we have a register with time configuration with times for all the qubits. And so the term, so for two qubit gate, we actually will ignore single qubit gates because they're not so interesting. It's also harder to analyze an arbitrary circuit. So we only have those two qubit gates in this 1D circuit. And so what it does, and I already said that, so for every gate in this quantum circuit that I showed you at the beginning between qubits Q and P, what we have is that we have a term which says, you know, if the let's say, well, there actually should be a P and a Q here, these times are S, and they're both updated to S plus 1. So both the times move forward. And this term is there to make the Hamiltonian positive semi-definite, and it also plays a role in the analysis, which is different from the standard one. Okay, so the times of interacting qubits are moved ahead if they're synchronized, and this is important, because it means that this term has no, has zero energy if the times are not synchronized. No. Okay, so what happens, so what kind of generation? Let's imagine you synchronize all the qubits at the beginning in terms of time, and then you apply the Hamiltonian to create a superposition of states, one of which is that those two qubits are now, the times are over here, right? And possible and other superpositions there. Now, it turned out to be very important to define something which I call a valid, we used to call it a proper time configuration, but then it has other, you know, suggestive relations which are not quite meant. So we call it a valid time configuration. What we mean by is the following. So if I start the circuit with all the qubits, the clock synchronized, my Hamiltonian will only evolve to certain time strings, time configurations. Those I call valid. And what are the properties of those? Well, it's very simple. It cannot be that, for example, here, this qubit, this last one, its time is over here, while its partner still has a time before the gate. That cannot happen, right? Because in order to get there, its partner must have also gone through the gate. It does not mean that all qubits have to have synchronized time. It just means that, so that's what it says, for no pair of qubits interacting at a time t in the circuit is the clock of one qubit past t and the other clock of the other qubit before t. And so the circuit Hamiltonian, which we construct, which we said how to construct, preserves the subspace. So you can think about, of course, you know, it's a circuit. So there is a causal structure for this. And that has a relation with this configuration. So you can really say in this way, so you, you so you can say, well, if I have, I can have unsynchronized times, for example, like this. This qubit has a time over here, but this gate has already happened, so that time is over there. So they're not synchronized. I can continue like that. That's not synchronized, or it goes over there. So you could say that that's a valid time configuration. But if I would continue this to infinity, then none of the qubits, of course, which I can't because the circuit has a beginning and end, but if I would continue it, then that would be a zero energy state, right? Because all the times would be zero, would be all the clock times would be asynchronized, so it would never pick up any energy. So you can see, you can actually show, I mean, it doesn't take much. So these valid times configurations, they are, cannot be any causal relation between the states of the qubits. So between any, so the time configuration is a whole, all configuration of times. And so for every pair of qubits, this you can call that their space-time interval has to be either space-like or light-like. Well, for invalid time configuration, there is a causal relation, so some intervals can be time-like. And that's with respect to this Minkowski metrics in well, there's nothing very deep about this, but this is just for 2D. So you can make the, write this formally. So if you have, I don't know. Let's see. So I have two qubits, P and Q. They both have an X coordinate and they have a time coordinate. And I take the difference between their time coordinates and the difference between X coordinates. And I say I can call such an interval light-like if this is equal. And in my case, C is 1. And that is exactly a meaning that they're on this line that I showed before. This one. And so similar for space-like, it's the, it's not a line, but it's more, it's a synchronized, the synchronized times and slightly, unsynchronized one. But the unphysical ones are these time-like intervals, at least the use of this Hamiltonian, it's very easy to construct zero energy states that are, which are invalid time configurations, because I can make them large, very unsynchronized. And I have zero energy with respect to the circuit Hamiltonian. Now, if I want to use this, the idea of the circuit Hamiltonian is that the ground state, which has zero energy, captures the history of the circuit. So these are kind of the bad guys. So I need to add a term to the Hamiltonian. I'll come to that at the end. That penalizes the invalid time configurations. And I can do that locally. But you can also ask that for the valid time configurations, is it possible that I have some zero energy states that do not capture the history of the circuit? So you can show, actually there we have some weird construction where this is not the case, but you can show that you can avoid these. That's to say, for example, if you were to continue, and this is because the circuit has a beginning and end, if you were to continue, you have this configuration, but here the circuit ends, so you have to have something that's synchronized here. So there is some, so in the circuits that we analyze, we can there are no zero energy valid time configurations, and we can show that there is a history state. Now, what is that history state? It's this state. So in the standard model, I had one clock. And what is the history state? It's a superposition of the clock being at different times. And next to it is the state of the circuit at those times. And in this case, the history state is a superposition over all these proper times. These proper times, they're like these strings. And we'll get to them. And for that sort of string, that corresponds to a certain number of gates that have been applied. And that's captured by this. Yeah? So it's a partial completion of the circuit. Maybe in this region, more gates were applied to the string. Goes like this. So it means that for this one, these three gates have only been applied.
Pardon?
Yeah?
Are the number of valid time configurations polynomial or exponential?
It's exponential. Yeah, exponential, yeah. Yeah, because you can go, yeah, because the string, we'll see that later, the string can go.
So the amplitude on the final time configuration is then exponentially smaller, right?
Yes. Yeah, so you have to, but the thing is that if you only look at the output of one, you don't need to complete the circuit for all the other guys necessarily, right? So if I say I want to look at the output of one qubit, it could be some string, which is...
for a decision problem circuit.
Yeah, example. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so there's... where's the chalk? where do you... Oh, there's that mountain. It's closed. Oh, I'm going to break the box by my impatience. Okay. Oh, now I have to find a spot. Okay, so the first the thing is that you have, if you have the circuit and you're interested in this qubit at the end, so you say, well, any configuration that has... that part of the circuit, it's just the past causal cone, yeah? Everything that has influenced this final state, that should have been complete. Yeah. So there are many strings that contribute to that.
So this exponential cancels the other?
Yeah, so there's no worry. Well, okay, so it works, it all works out, yeah. I mean, yeah? No, we assume that every, so we, at the end, we proved the QMA completeness of this Mizell Hamiltonian with a penalty for the invalid configurations, but assuming that every wire has a single, you know, particle, because we cannot penalize that locally. That is indeed the problem.
Output qubit is the only one you care about. Presumably, you're not going to do any gates that aren't in its causal path, or do you have to pad the circuit with extra gates in order to make it?
Yeah, you mean. Well, you mean that you can map it onto some other thing? No.
If you're doing a circuit and there's only one output qubit,
mm-hmm.
You're not going to do any gates that don't.
No, right. You never need to do them. Yes. So you could just throw that all away. Yes.
The point is that still advancing. It's just that there's no gates there. There's no.
Sorry,
there's no. You still have. In this picture here, some of those boxes correspond to actual gates where you're doing something, and some of them are just the identity.
Yeah, but the thing is that. Okay, so what we wanted to do is to take. Well, for example, I was interested in how the gap depended on the depth, for example, which is. So. Okay, so you can look at one, how do you say? It's true for QMA, you're only interested in one gate, in one qubit at the end, but it's the Hamiltonian that you get, that for which you prove the QMA completeness that is interesting. And of course, I could also map that onto some standard construction, but then I would have to get a different Hamiltonian.
The triangles above and below.
Yeah, you don't need to. Right.
You actually need to have qubits there?
No, in principle not, right? It doesn't matter. Yes. They don't contribute.
But,
yeah.
But the argument you were saying about exponential suppression, it seems like it does depend on what you're there.
It's exponential in the size of the circuit and the past light cone of the readout bit.
But you could also ask, you could ask this. Then you could ask this. Maybe I do a quantum walk. So I prepare things here. I run the Hamiltonian for random time. And I haven't decided which qubit to look at. So I say, well, I want to make sure that any qubit that I look at, how long does it take for any qubit I look at, I'll get the right answer. So it's only the local observables that I want to reproduce. Or I want to have the whole, that is different.
But if you're doing QMA, I'm trying to understand what the construction means if you do QMA.
For QMA, you need to look only at one output qubit,
right.
Yes.
But that means you don't have to have those other qubits there, or you do?
No, in principle not, right? In principle, you can just make them the identity. So in that sense, the Hamiltonian with those being the identity gates would also be shown to be QMA complete.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. But and if the qubits are not there at all, it still works.
Yes. Also, the thing is that the spectral gap analysis depends a little bit on the structure of the circuit. So if I start modifying that, then I lose my translation invariance and all these kind of things. So that's a technical problem. Yeah. Okay, so now the thing is that, so the work that we really needed to do is okay, so we can show that the ground state is unique and it's this history state. And you can also show that this Hamiltonian corresponds to a Laplacian on a graph. And the points in this graph are these valid time strings. Yeah? So this is, so if you say, well, okay, we just bound the second smallest eigenvalues of Laplacian, you know, using some Markov chain techniques, actually is not so trivial or doesn't look very obvious. But there is actually a much better way of representing this. So I have periodic boundary conditions in space. And now what I want to do is I just want to map, I want to represent the circuit a little bit differently. And it's a very simple thing. Where's that eraser thing? All right, I guess this is really the last one. But I don't know, is the eraser up here or is it behind? John really made it hard for me here. Hiding all the tools. Okay. Okay, so instead of, I want to represent my circuit slightly differently. So let's imagine the times are on the edges. So this is a, you know, say this is, so these are qubits. And this is a synchronized time configuration. And each of these squares is just a gate. So what happens when the string moves forward, this gate happens that this goes to there. So then I can just draw, I can also draw the string or this configuration as a, we have to have a different color, as a string like this. Yeah. So what happens is that now these two, it becomes, I need another color. Is there another color in this box? I don't know. What? Okay, so this is a particular time configuration, a valid time configuration. It's a string. And so what happens when a gate happens is just that something like, you know, a segment like this is mapped onto something like this. It preserves the length of the string. So every time there is a, you know, some kind of some bend like that, it can move. So here it can also move. But if I have a segment like this, this cannot move. Only if it's like, you know, for example, like this, then it can move to that. So that's, and then you can understand that I can parameterize this string. If I fix this point, I can just parameterize by bit string, you know, left, right. Yeah. So it's just a bit string. And I can look at my Hamiltonian in that bit string basis. And so, so we have some technical thing where we also take periodic boundary conditions in time. One can do this, and there's periodic boundary conditions in space. And so you can also, yeah. Okay, so it's like a domain wall that is moving and wiggling, and you don't want to, the length of this domain wall should not increase, so we're at zero temperature, yeah? So, but there's another way of looking at it, is that you can actually map this onto a Heisenberg model. So I said for the periodic boundary conditions, I need a boundary point. Yeah, so, and then it's the string. So this boundary point is called tau. And what happens, this boundary point sometimes is also moved. So this boundary point, if this gate is done, this boundary point is moved there, and these things are happening.
The
so yeah, for now, they're a convenient way that I could do the analysis with that boundary. But actually, in a moment, I'll come to a much even simpler boundary that we found later. Yeah, and I'll show you what the easier boundary conditions are. So when this, so you see, if this boundary point moves, it's coupled to the movement of these bits. But otherwise, these bits, you know, they just move independent of the boundary point. So you kind of you split this into forward movement is just on the line. This boundary point moves on the line. So you put in a plane wave state as an eigenstate, and you get a Hamiltonian. So you put in a state like this for this boundary point, and there's some technical things to put in a Hamiltonian HK, which does depend on this label K, which is it's a spin a half Heisenberg chain with a twisted K-dependent boundary because of this coupling here. What do you want to say about this? So I think the thing is, what you can maybe understand is that why should it be if I label going left by zero and going right by one, what this model does, it's mapped 0, 1 onto 1, 0. And so that's like, you could also say it's a particle hopping, but I also have a diagonal term. So in order for the Hamiltonian to be positive semi-definite, in order to be a Laplacian, I also have a term in which, you know, the times are not changed. It's just and so that contributes a ZZ term in this Heisenberg model. Anyhow, but so the thing is, we can bound the gap using this map. Okay, so that was some work. I don't know if this I'm going way too late, right? So I also have these invalid or improper, it should be called invalid time configurations. So one needs to add, so we have these terms that do the hopping, then you also need to penalize invalid time configurations. And you'd like to do that locally. And we can show we can do that also with quartic interactions, for which, you know, the improper times will always have, it commutes with the Hamiltonian. So we can split the eigenspaces up in two spaces, one the improper times and the one the proper times, and the improper times they pick up a finite energy penalty. So that's what we need to do for QMA. Okay, so now I want to talk a little bit about quantum walks and quantum adiabatic computation. So one thing I found interesting about this model is that if you were to run the circuit, it would take time d, right? The depth of the circuit. So is it possible that we would prepare some string at the beginning and we do some, you know, some random quantum random walk, and we would find maybe one qubit at the, or any qubit at the output in time d? Now, I think this is actually not likely to be the case, because you can, well, intuitively you can understand this, is that these particles, you know, they're holding hands, right? They have to hop together. So that's this analogy with the kindergartners, that one of them wants to maybe go forward, but they all have to go together. So you'd expect that the efficiency of which this moves, the string moves together, is slowed down by the length of the string. By n, so of course it would be nice to have something where we could show we can do things in time scaling with only with the depth.
Let's make the ones in the middle run faster, though. I mean, so that, you know,
they depend, right? They interact with the other qubit, so they mm-hmm. they can't, you know, there's like.
So tune the coupling between them so that you offset that. So that,
yeah.
Some holding is weaker than others.
Yeah, but they have to do their logic things together, right? It's not a matter of, you know, there's a causal relation between the state, my state, and the other one's state. If the other one's state is way behind, then I think that there's no way of dealing with that. I'll show you a different way of actually getting some forward motion. Of course, if you could put it in some kind of, plane wave state, the thing is, I want to start with the string at the beginning in a localized way. Yeah. If, you know, in a Feynman model, you take a wave packet with forward momentum, and there you go. Yeah. So you say, well, maybe there's an analogy here, but I have to have some finite momentum for it. Could be, but I think this that will not correspond to a localized string state, or at least I don't know how to do that.
Okay.
No?
Can you sort of stretch your string in places where the spot system is replaced by the entity, or even just by local operations? Right? Because the fact that they have to move together is fixed by the fact that you're...
Well, you're saying that it's only one particle that has to get to the end. Is that what you mean? So the other guys we don't care about... So that, I mean, it is a different question to say, does that particle, can that reach the end of the computation depth D, or do all of them do that? This is slightly different. Yeah.
Also, you said this ballistic solution is one way to get through it in time
yeah.
T, but there's another solution that is localized with the one finite construction where you make the couplings in the clock get stronger and stronger and stronger to the middle of the evolution and weaker on the outside, and tune the couplings just right.
But this is more adiabatic computation or really okay. Oh, yeah, yeah, there is actually, well, we have something like that indeed. Yeah, you can do something. Well, I have thought about that in a model of adiabatic computation where you just sort of transfer the qubits to the next over the gate.
Mm-hmm.
And with the okay, but maybe we can talk about that too. Okay, so now I want to change the geometry a little bit. So it turns out that that it's actually easier to look at this boundary, to look at a different boundary condition. So now I want to just take a square like this. And what is nice about this is that, so this is the sort of first qubit here, that this boundary point is fixed now. So if I want to characterize a string, it's just some kind of, you know, thing on this lattice, and it has to end. It has to end here, yes. And so there's no boundary point. So that string is just characterized by, you know, plus by a bit string. Yeah? So I map onto a Heisenberg model, or for quantum walk, I map onto just a hopping Hamiltonian. And so actually, it turns out that Jansing has analyzed this model. So in my model, or in our model, there is the particles are on the edges, and so the edges here in this picture, you have to think about the string running over the gray boxes. So the edges are these vertices here between these boxes, and in his model, they're actually particles with spin on gray squares. And so these big dots are particles. And then he has to say, well, this particle hops forward only if there are particles here present. And that's also a way of getting this forward motion. Yeah. So it's actually quite a nice paper that I think he analyzed. Yes, and so the way you could run a computation where you say, well, in this region, there is actually unitary gates happening. And what I want, I prepare a string that goes like this, that goes, it's all light-like here. And then I apply my Hamiltonian for some random time, and I want to know whether I find the string over there. And so in that model, he didn't formulate it that way, but what the nice thing is that I think you could think about that it turns out he also tried to analyze it on a torus, which was harder, because there's sort of no entropy argument, because the idea here is that you say, well, okay, here the string all goes this way. So I could say, well, it's all zeros. Yeah? And here it's all ones. Now, what is the interaction? What does the Hamiltonian do? It just, if a zero is next to a one, it can flip. So the particle's just diffusing. And so these particles are all here. They will just diffuse over time. And if you take the circuit region to be fairly small, then, of course, there are many more strings here in the bulk than, you know, the ones at the boundary. So there's sort of an entropy argument that says that you go to a configuration which is much more likely. Yeah? This initial configuration has all these zeros here and all ones there, which is a very unlikely configuration. I don't know. That's my intuitive understanding of how you can prove this. So what he says here, so you have a circuit region of k by k, and the whole region is n by n, and you can prove that there's a time of order k such that the probability of finding the whole string in the output region, so this whole thing goes like there, is some constant, is close to one. And you can also show that if you pick a random time from 0 to infinity, but you can bound it by some polynomial, that the probability of finding a string in the output region goes to 1, if k is small enough. Because just the number of strings that go through this region becomes very, very small. Okay, so it turns out, so this actually is a nicer, this geometry is nicer to look at. And so now, so we wanted to also show that you could use this this Hamiltonian to do a quantum adiabatic computation. And so what one way you could do this is to turn off and on gates layer by layer or gate by gate. And so let's say all the hopping terms are off except for one gate, and then you adiabatically you turn that on. So it's like, you know, it's like a double well. I mean, if you think about one line, you have some a line of double well of potential of wells, or you have a line of wells, yeah. And there's no most transitions are off at the beginning. The well is lowest, and so that's where the particle is. And then you turn that interaction off, so the particle can go to the next well, and you make the second well the lowest. So then the particle is localized in the second well. And then you're done with that. You turn off the tunneling between those wells, and you continue on the next well. Anyhow, you can do something like that for here. But the point is that you need a lot of knobs to turn on this every layer. And there's been work by Flamia and co-workers to analyze such a scheme where you'd have, say, maybe a single knob that you turn off. So in the usual way of doing quantum adiabatic computation, there's one parameter which you turn, you gradually turn, and then you go from some initial state where the string is in some initial state to the final state, which is this history state of the computation. Okay, so we can also, what should we choose? So we want to look at something like that. We have the circuit Hamiltonian. We want to have a parameter lambda that we gradually change. As originally lambda is 0 and the end of lambda is 1. And we need to have some initializing configuration. So what should we choose that to be? And we'd like to be able to spectrally analyze that. So which is like, okay, how we do this? And then I think we're sort of lucky. So so what do you want the init to be? Well, I want the string to be this one, right? Now you see that string is very light-like, so to say. So if I put in a constraint that qubits should not be synchronized, and nearest neighbor qubits not be synchronized, I can favor this string and that string over all others. So either it's bent, this way, or it's bent at the other way. So then I still have to break the symmetry between those two strings, the one that goes like this and the one that goes like that. And I can do that by saying that the time of this first qubit has to be, this one. So the in my case, the qubits live on these vertices instead of that one. And so what is nice now is that that actually it maps beautifully on a well-studied model. So we had the Heisenberg ferromagnet in actually a sector where the number of particles is n over 2, right? Because we always have to have n over 2 ones. And it just turns out that one can, that this term breaking the symmetry is a boundary term. And this Q-deformed Heisenberg ferromagnet has a parameter, has this parameter in it. But anyhow, so the result is that there's actually, this has been analyzed. And it has so the Heisenberg ferromagnet has an SU2 symmetry, and this Q-deformed Heisenberg ferromagnet, which has also been well studied by Bethe Ansatz, has a different symmetry, which is a generalization of an SU2 symmetry. And so there are also just three operators, sigma x, sigma y, sigma z, but they don't have the usual SU2 commutation relation, but a slight transformation, a change of this. So the point is that the gap actually is constant as long as you're away from this point lambda smaller than 1.
Sorry, what's the Q dependence in the Hamiltonian?
Here, it's here, this one.
Oh, you just define a parameter Q.
Yeah, so I don't show you the Q dependence. Okay. This is the Hamiltonian, and there's also, so we put in the constraint of the boundary depending on some C of lambda, and we have to choose the C of lambda so that it matches exactly with this model with that symmetry, but we can do that. And the Q for this Q deformed, I don't give you the Hamiltonian, relates like this to the lambda. Okay. So, okay, so, do it on time. I don't know. What is the offset? I think it's a, I like the model. I wish I could define some kind of continuum limit. Because then maybe some things are easier to analyze.
Why do you even need the Z of ZZ constants? Because without those, it would be free fermions.
Yes. That, so for the thing is that for the, if I want to prove that the ground state is the history state, that it's not true if I don't have the ZZ couplings. And this is because the, so in the, I don't know if you know the Kitaev construction, there's also diagonal and off-diagonal couplings. But the off-diagonal couplings, the diagonal couplings are kind of irrelevant because the, let me say it this way. If I only have the off-diagonal couplings, I get an adjacency matrix of a graph. If I have the on-diagonal coupling, I get the Laplacian. And the graph does not have constant degree. What does it mean? The graph is, every point in the graph is a time configuration. And if the time configuration is synchronized, it can hop to a lot of neighbors. But if it's very unsynchronized, it has very few neighbors. So the degree is not constant. So therefore, the spectrum of the Laplacian is not the same as the spectrum of the adjacency matrix. But for that's for, if I'm interested in the ground state, so that's for QMA in quantum adiabatic computation. But for a quantum walk, it's not, that's not the determining factor. So that state that I showed, this history state, that's just not the, I don't know what the ground state is if I just have the adjacency matrix. And for the graph, and for the Kitaev construction, the graph is just a line. It's just the graph is a line, and every vertex talks to two neighbors. Okay. Now you could ask what is this actually a useful model? I don't know, because in some ways, say, can I do my computation in this model? The problem is, of course, that there is some, it's not necessarily very robust. So I can, maybe the wrong gates are done. So I can have modification of Hamiltonian where not the right gate is done. I could be protected against that if I encode my quantum information in some, with some quantum error correction. But the problem is that these particles have to hop together, but there will always be, because I have to get them perturbatively, there will always be single particle terms that I have to assume that are there. And so it's not clear, how you can actually make this robust. So it's true. I mean, I haven't actually looked at these details, this is an open question, I would say. You would also say, well, why would you consider a model where the quantum information moves through, gates instead of being stationary? We use up one of our space dimensions. It doesn't look very useful, right? We already have so few dimensions. So, if you just have photons, they are moving. But I am thinking about, whether there are some more concrete proposals about how you actually do this with electrons. But then you all have a problem that you have backscattering, instead of going through the gate. You just... Okay, so where are we with time? So now something completely different. Okay, so I was going to have to talk about quantum error correction. I'm actually not going to talk about quantum error correction very much. So actually one comment I want to make. So I have a review in quantum error correction. This is under revisions, and I'm very happy if you have corrections or comments, because I'm processing them. And I have set up a special email address. So if you say this is all wrong and she simplifies things, and I've written this myself, so I'm sure that I've forgotten things or have been inaccurate at points. So if you're interested, you can send me some comments. And we sort of work on the this workshop. People have work on the software side of making a scalable computer. But I think we should also think about whether the hardware that we have is actually can be expected to be good enough to realize quantum error correction. Because if at least I've been studying superconducting qubits over the last half year, and I'm amazed at how big the gap is between, you know, the sort of formalistic way in which we do this and the actual physics. And maybe we should think more about the physics and what the limits are that the physics impose. So, okay, so this is very speculative. I don't really understand this. So, but I just want to throw out some ideas, so maybe you have some better ideas. So if you say, well, what physics is the quantum computation going to be built from? Well, it's not going to be coming out of the weak interaction or, you know, from strong interactions in nuclei or something. It's going to be from our garden variety physics, meaning it's quantum electrodynamics, and even the relativistic aspects of there are not very important. So it's going to be coming from quantized electromagnetic fields, or largely classical, interacting with matter. Yeah. And so largely with electrons, or, you know, spins. So that can be in the optical, in the radio frequency, so for NMR and so, or in a microwave regime for superconducting qubits. And if we'd only have quantized electromagnetic fields free, then no sources, that would just give us linear optics. So it would not be strong. So we need to couple to matter. But the interaction is not, you know, that there's a constant. And it's a dimension, so it's a fine structure constant that I want to claim, or it's not actually my idea, I think. This has been studied a bit in the superconducting qubit literature, that imposes some constraints. And maybe this is the threshold that we need to consider. So you can ask, because this is a dimensionless constant. So you say, well, do we live in the right universe where this, now imagine that this is, you know, a million times smaller. Would then we would be able to build a quantum computer? Shouldn't building a quantum computer depend on the value of this constant? Because being dimensionless?
Is it easier or harder when it's smaller?
I think it's, well, okay, I'll give you some evidence that if it's smaller, it's harder. It's not so trivial, I think, actually, to analyze this, yeah? Is it, yeah. Okay, but so what I want to do now is, I think it's an interesting question to say, can I build a model, or can I come up with a theoretical question and say, you know, quantum electrodynamics, and I try to build a computational model on that basis, where the only parameter is that number. And can I then, do I see obstructions towards making scalable quantum computation, or can I classically simulate it? So there is one way in which this alpha determines an upper bound on some strength and gives us trouble. Gives people in superconducting qubits or in optics in quantum cavity QED trouble. Yeah, so typically, the idea is you have, you know, light matter interactions. So, and this goes via then, let's assume it goes via a dipolar coupling. Yeah, so there is some, you know, atom, and you have two levels, electron being one of those two levels, having a dipole moment that couples to the electric field. Yeah, and so this type of physics is described by a James Cummings model, okay, where we have our atom, say two levels, and we have a mode of the electromagnetic field. So for simplicity, we only have one. And then there's a coupling. And this is the whole workhorse. Yeah. So in transmon qubits, everything, you have to do your measurement through there. You have to do your single gates through there. You have to do your two-qubit gates. Now there's higher level structure. But it all goes through this coupling. Yeah? The coupling with the radiation field that you can manipulate, you send pulses in and so on. Now, the thing is that you can, so what is the big advance for these superconducting qubits with this circuit QED paradigm? It's one of the big advances, and this is a simplified picture, is that the strength of this coupling divided by omega, which is a measure of this strength, which WQ and WR are sort of similar in size, order mega, gigahertz, that's order 10 to the minus 2, whereas in cavity QED, it's order 10 to the minus 6. And one of the reasons for that is that this is these cavities are 3D cavities, so the density, there's the intensity of the electric field at one spot is lower, and the atomic levels have a small dipole moment. And so one of the realizations, at least this is what these guys say, which are of course the experts, that the 1D circuit, you have a sort of 1D cavity, 1D circuit, it's a much more confined electric field, much higher strength, and you have a large dipole moment, the way you can set up the way the transmon qubit couples to this electric field. And so they've done an explicit analysis by which you can, with arguments, you can show that there is a bound for the current qubits that are of interest with the dipolar coupling that for, say, Rydberg atoms in a 3D cavity, you have such a scaling that G over omega goes like alpha to the 3/2, and for a 1D thing, it goes like order alpha, the square root of alpha, and this 3/2 and square root is determined by this 3D versus 1D cavity. So that shows in some ways that this G, which is, you know, where all this stuff has to come from, is limited in strength. And that's you have to fight against that the whole time. Yeah. So but there are, you know, you have to always be careful because there have some, for example, in this paper, they also describe a different coupling way in a Josephson junction shunted by capacitance can couple in a circuit QED, and they actually get this scaling. This is not being explored as a qubit. So, you know, there you see that actually if alpha is, you know, have the opposite case with opposite dependence of alpha. So
you mentioned AMO technologies and superconducting technologies, but what about semiconductor technologies? To my knowledge, you don't need QED.
Yeah, but there are also the yes, but there is a coupling with the magnetic field, and this is even weaker often. Yeah. So NMR or electron spins and so on. Yeah. I mean, and now I'm focusing on this. Yes. So you could also say, well, why they have this dipolar coupling, you can also have coupling with the spin. And so that's what I'm not discussing here.
Okay.
Yeah. I just want to show that there are constraints that have been observed to come from this, the size of the,
there is a sort of trade-off always because bigger coupling means bigger coherence. And
yes,
so
yeah.
Smaller
yeah, yeah.
Have longer
yeah, so in some sense, it's a controllable coupling that you need. Indeed, a bigger coupling would say, well, then I don't have an atom at all. It's just perfect. Yeah. But, okay, that is true. I'm not saying that I have any, you know, deep insights into this. But okay, so what is, for example, the consequence of the weak interaction with matter is that, you know, in the optical regime, it's hard to do photon detection or single photon generation, right? So you convert the photons into a current, but if the coupling is weak, it's hard to do that. Yeah? In the microwave regime, you're faced with another problem is that the energy of the photons is very low, so it's hard, so they're under development to have a photon detection in the microwave regime. So what they do instead is they have their weak coherent states, attenuated coherent states at low temperature, and have to amplify them to actually measure the state. So that, you know, presents an additional technological challenge. The other thing is that, of course, the nonlinearities, which you want to exploit for squeezing or amplification, or to make, for example, code words of certain qubit into oscillator codes, they are weak. So because, for example, if you're in a dispersive regime, so these WQ minus WR, they are large compared to G, you can get an effective interaction where this quartic term goes like G to the fourth divided by delta to the third. And so if G is relatively small or suppressed, that term will be small. And so like I said at the beginning, you can ask, is there a way in which if you would have this G very small, I don't know how to formulate this question. Can you somehow show that it's not universal for quantum computation? As we have linear optics, we don't even know whether we can simulate that, but let's not assume we have single photon sources and photon detection, because that would also require coupling with matter, so we can't just assume that to exist. We need to have a model for how strong that can be, what we can generate. And so if we have that this very small, then maybe we can see we cannot. I mean, yeah.
You mean with noise in the present?
No, not noise. Not just this weak.
But I mean, if you just wait longer.
Yeah, but it's also okay, yes. Well, okay, so you need to have noise, yes. You can say, because the point is, of course, that this is a scale, G over omega, and the point is that there's dephasing happening. Yeah? So there's, and there's photon loss and other processes. Of course, this is a very stylized picture, in which you have a single mode, which is already, you know, the point is the cavity, you use the cavity physics to isolate one or a few modes and have them have strong fields. And
But the noise is also scaling with alpha.
Yes. Yeah, and so the thing is that indeed, so you can take, and I remember, I think that they do that in this analysis, you say, okay, well, this is bad, but you have to also include the dependence on the coherence, even the coherence rate also has to sit in here. Yeah. So that's not taken into this thing. I think then the scaling of alpha does change. I mean, the size of the qubit, you know, it's the, you know, for this 1D circuit, this, you know, this, well, how do you say? This dipole is large because this is, the size of that is large. So the size of the atom matters because it determines this dipole moment.
Yeah, so maybe that's superconducting.
Yeah, that plays a role. That's definitely, the two effects. There's one is that sort of that, the size is the length of this width of the cavity is almost completely the size of your atom, and the second effect is a 1D structure.
To my understanding, they pick up the parameters, you know, for superconducting qubits in particular, they pick up the parameters just from what electronics they have available. You know, it's always 6 gigahertz transition frequency, etc., etc. So it's all very robust just because they have this electronics that works best in this range, but not in the other range.
What do you mean? That the regime is picked out by the electronics?
Right. That's what.
Well, it's true that they can. I guess they can use that electronics. This is very stable. I think they have very stable coherent states they can generate in that regime. But it's not only that, right?
It's, I've been told
okay. But I mean, I don't think that. But I think that this analysis, but of course, this analysis doesn't depend on this. The point here is not how many megahertz and so on, it's the dimensionless quantities. Yeah.
Also, I mean, just very briefly thinking about it, it seems like the noise might scale the opposite way with alpha. I mean, if you.
It's stronger coupling, yes, it's more noise.
I mean, Like for instance, if you assume that leakage out of the cavity is your main source of noise, it seems like if you set alpha to zero, it's as if the cavity was like vacuum, so you leak right out.
Mm-hmm. So then that would be good if you leak right out, because you don't have time to. I mean,
if you decrease alpha, your coupling gets lower, but your noise increases. In that case. Because, I mean, if the main source of noise is leakage out of the cavity.
Yeah, of course, the problem is there are many sources of noise. One is what I think they call the Purcell effect, which is leaking into the this mode and then that leaking out of the cavity. But that's only one contribution. Yeah. So the other thing... Other point I want to make is that in some ways it's an asymmetry between, so we can think about a toric code, as I think is the original paper by Dennis et al. It was, you know, you have electric charges and magnetic charges. And in the toric code, the plaquette and the star terms are equally strong. That's kind of, so we say, well, we want to make that toric code physically from some physical model with dual, you know, with conjugate variables. And the thing is that there is the fine structure constant can also be viewed as that there's an asymmetry with the strength of the magnetic and electric field. So it can be written as this, where this is the impedance of the vacuum. This is the speed of light, electric constant. And so that is the measure the strength of electric field over the strength of the magnetic field in vacuum. And that is in units of ohms. So you have to divide it by some resistance. And this is then this resistant quantum, which is the Hall conductance in integer fractions of, well, the Hall conductance is measured in integer fractions of 1 over RK. And so this is, I think, also how they determine alpha. So small alpha means, in some ways, that there is a symmetry between the strengths of these two fields. And I think this also, so there's another paper which also show, they say, defying the fine structure constant. So what I want to say is that their engineering effort to, you know, it's not like, okay, there's a law of physics that says you can't do it. It's just a matter of how we engineer ourselves out. And we work with quantum error correction, we work on the software side of this. But this is looked sort of the hardware side. But you can also ask if there's a point at which we cannot engineer ourselves out, like a threshold. Okay, so if you have an LC circuit, you can think about that as you know, it's a harmonic oscillator with two variables, which are conjugate variables, which is the charge on the conductor and the magnetic flux. And there's magnetic energy that's converted into electric energy and vice versa. And if you look at this, so they're just conjugate variables, then you can say, okay, well, this is sort of like a kinetic term. So the C plays the role of a mass, and this is my potential term. And now you say, well, what about the relative strength of these quantities, which is the characteristic impedance of the circuit? And so this is, again, not a rule that this has to be less than the vacuum, but typically for such a circuit it is, as long as you don't use any Josephson injunctions or other sources of getting L. And so the Z vacuum can be related back to alpha. So the point is that it's actually very hard to get a large inductance without also getting a large capacitance. So if the inductance is very large, if the inductance is very small, then this is very large. This potential is very steep. So you're kind of, this phase variable has only small fluctuations. And so there are large fluctuations in charge. But then, so this picture actually changes when you have a Josephson injunction, because then there's a different way of getting an inductance. And you can have something called, you know, the Cooper pair box, which is the precursor of the transmon qubit, in which you do not have large structure. You have, you know, one or two Cooper pairs on an island, so you can control the charge on the island. You don't have large fluctuations. You're not an eigenstate of the phase variable, but an eigenstate close to an eigenstate of the charge variable. But so there's engineering challenges that to go beyond Cooper pair box or transmon qubit towards having a super inductance. Yeah? So this also alerts to work that John Preskill did, I think, where people think about using multiple Josephson injunctions. So the only point I want to make is that this seems to be something there are constraints that are given by the physics, and you have to engineer, you know, around it. So I think it's not completely crazy to think about whether there is a regime of these parameters. If it all depends only on one parameter, we can say, well, take the parameter to be, you know, really, really small or really, really large. And is there a point at which really we can understand whether this is not going to work? But I don't know how to actually, you know, do this, because your question is like, you know, here you also have superconductivity. So what other parameters do you have to throw in other parameters to characterize your physics? That's, I don't know. Okay, so that's, yeah. Okay, so then the software, yeah, maybe I won't say anything. So I have ongoing software projects on quantum error correction. And this was just something I came up with the day before yesterday. So, yeah. Okay.
Well, I agree. It's an intriguing question to ask. What is the best possible universe or worst possible for quantum computing? But of course, what makes it hard to answer is one has to find fundamental limits on what can be achieved through engineering.
Yeah.
And I mean,
right. I mean, yeah, but I mean, every engineering step uses the same tools, right? It's like making.
I think if one, you know, restricts the question in a suitable way, you can say interesting things.
But I mean, if you just take quantum electrodynamics, that non-work, I mean.
Yeah. Well, so right, I think I remember a paper a long time ago by Plinio and Knight, and they said in the case of an ion trap. Suppose you want to drive a single qubit gate using a laser, and you know, and you detune the laser from the transition, blah blah blah, and you can ask what's the optimal way of doing that. And so they, because there's a trade-off between the strength of the laser field inducing decoherence and the speed at which you can do the Rabi plots, they said. It scales like Alpha cube, that thing.
I see.
Try to do the optimal thing. But of course, that was in that particular universe of hardware and a particular way of realizing the gate.
Right, so yeah. So it's very hard to grasp the question is putting this as a good model for that. Yes. So maybe these particular examples are. Yeah. Okay.